Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Big Ticket, Variety and iHeart's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today, I have two guests on The Big Ticket, Wilson Cruz and Olivia Munn. First up, Cruz is here to talk about his trailblazing work as an openly gay actor and his new endeavor behind the camera as a producer of Visible out in television, Apple TV Plus's five-part docuseries about the history of LGBTQ representation on television. Then later in the show, Munn reminisces about shooting her new Netflix rom-com ensemble, Love Wedding Repeat, in Italy, how she feels about dream weddings, plus she weighs in on the Harvey Weinstein sentencing. I'll be right back with Wilson Cruz. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's Wilson Cruz.
Hi, Wilson Cruz.
Hi, Mark Malkin.
Thanks for stopping by.
I mean, we've only known each other for over a decade.
More than a decade. Yeah. I would see when I first moved to LA, and I would see, and I'd be like, that's Wilson Cruz. And then you turn out to be such a nice guy.
Well, on a good day, yeah.
I have a lot to talk to you about. First, let's just start with Visible.
Yeah.
Tell us, what is Visible?
Visible is 7 years of my life. Visible is a five-part documentary. Each episode is an hour long, about the impact that television has had on the LGBTQ movement, but also how the LGBTQ movement has used the medium of television in order to tell the stories of LGBTQ people so that we can move the needle for acceptance. And We interview almost everyone that you could possibly think of, mm-hmm. Who's played a major part in the movement in terms of television. And we've also interviewed activists who used television in their activism. Some rarely seen clips from throughout television history. In order to tell the story of how we used this very intimate medium in order to tell the truth about LGBTQ people in our lives.
What do you want people to get from it?
I want people to remember that where we are today in terms of visibility was hard fought, that it was a concerted effort to use this medium in a productive way. I want people to be inspired by it so that they continue the work, but also continue to push forward in terms of visibility so that we see a more accurate depiction of who we are as a community. But also remind people that this medium can be used for good and that we have used it for good. And hopefully we can inspire a new generation of activists and content creators to continue to push forward. And when I say push forward, I mean in terms of gender, of race, of lived experiences. There's so much story left to tell. So I hope that people are inspired by this in order to do so.
What surprised you? What did you learn so you said you got involved 7 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, listen, I've been in the business for a little while, and I started my career off in the gay press, so I saw a lot of, this is a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a lot of the moments that are part of the series. I remember when those moments happened, and I felt like I knew a lot, but there were things that I was like, oh.
Yeah.
What surprised you? What was one thing that stood out?
There's so much that surprised me. I have a long list of things. The first thing that comes to mind is Tim Gunn.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Gunn surprised me because, I think we approached Tim Gunn because we thought we'd get some great color commentary and
right.
We love him and he was an interesting person to talk to who lived. Here's the sad part. There aren't a lot of people from his generation that we could talk to because of the AIDS epidemic. So we thought we would have Tim Gunn and talk about, funny things. And he dropped a big old bomb on us in terms of his experience growing up and his relationship with his father, who was in the FBI and was very machismo, lack of a better word. That surprised me. I didn't know a lot about the advocacy that went into getting A Question of Love produced, mm-hmm. which was a television movie that Jane Alexander and Jenna Rollins starred in about a lesbian couple.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah, and so, remember, yeah. But that it came out of a response to a policewoman episode
right.
about murderous lesbians who are killing elderly people for their checks.
She says it's not even real.
Right, but what I love about it is that they talk about how lesbians were invisible, that right. they kind of were under the radar, and nobody really, you know, that in these network offices.
Right.
And so they saw the script and brought, you know, and started to create real noise around it
right.
and then used this news story around this real life couple who was fighting for parental rights to get this story told
right.
instead. So, you know, what surprised me, what moves me about mm-hmm. about so many of these stories is how people purposefully took action in order to be more visible in response to their own invisibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think people forget I think Marsha Warfield says this exact thing. She says, I think people forget just how invisible gay people were
right.
in the 50s and 60s. So there was a generation of this community that said no more. And let's use this new thing, this newfangled thing called
mm-hmm.
television that is in everybody's home and their bedrooms and their living rooms and really tell people who we are. And make ourselves human as opposed to these villainous, demonic depictions and ideas of who we were at the time.
I mean, I was surprised. I don't think I knew about this, but then I had a memory of it. Not a memory of it happening, but there were activists who were like storming live television newscasts.
Yeah.
Walter Cronkite is in the middle of a newscast.
Mark Siegel pops up in the middle of Walter Cronkite's
live newscast.
And, you know, people are like, well, you know, some people I'm sure at the time thought, well, this is crazy. Maybe this isn't helpful. But you know what it was it forced people to have a conversation
right.
about
and
why this man did this, right?
And in the documentary, as they point out, it also inspired Walter Cronkite to do more LGBTQ stories.
Yes.
Which
was the point.
Which is the point. CBS
yeah.
was, you know, it's the gold standard of news at the time. So if you have Walter Cronkite doing LGBTQ stories, that's amazing.
And they ended up being friends for years. So Walter Cronkite learned something from
right.
that man who interrupted him. Barbara Walters, you know,
right.
wouldn't let the story go. She wanted to make sure that his story was told. So, you know, activists also used television, and we still do.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole organization called GLAAD that uses it.
Do you recall the first time you ever saw yourself represented in any, as obviously as a Latino man, but as a gay Latino on television?
Well, I mean, as a Latino, the first person who comes to mind is Rita Moreno.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was and still is a Puerto Rican icon
right.
and was a first on so many levels, you know, an Oscar award winner, an EGOT. She is, you know, she is my inspiration. You know, when I did Rent on Broadway, I literally thought about her in West Side Story and just kind of did my version of that. But
what happened the first time you met Rita?
Well, I met her at the GLAAD Awards, and she was a huge supporter of GLAAD and the movement, a great ally to us. And I actually met her at a benefit that we both sang in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I fangirled for sure. But, you know, the first time you know, I've said this before, and I mean it, I stand by it. The first time I saw myself on television was when I saw myself on television. There was no gay, young, Latino, African-American, even anyone of color,
right.
Who I could relate to, who spoke to my lived experience. And that's why when my so-called life came around and I read that script, that's why I knew how powerful and how useful this character and this series was going to be. It's why it meant so much to me. It's why I made an agreement with myself that if the show ever got on the air, I would come out to my parents, because I knew I wanted to have a public conversation about young people of color, LGBT people of color. And I could only do that if I were out.
You're 19 years old at the time.
I was 19. I was about 20 by the time the show aired.
Did you feel the weight of it then? Or do you look back and you feel like maybe you felt the weight, but that's more of a memory, more of like, as time has gone by, you realize what I mean, it was pivotal. It was huge.
I think I knew exactly what my responsibility was.
Wow.
I think, you know, I think it was the innocence of youth, right? There was the naivete of youth, and I had some of that, but I also had the boldness of youth. Mm. I think when we're young, and you see this in the documentary over and over, where you see young people who want to live out loud and take the opportunity to do so when it presents itself. And I think I was one of those people. I think I knew that I had an opportunity to make some noise, and I wanted to do that.
When did you know you made a difference? Was there a moment?
You know, it's funny because I talk about this, I've said this before, but when I was doing the show, when the show was on the air, I didn't hear a whole lot from young people, because I think so many people were of that age couldn't really talk about it, right?
Or they probably
they couldn't approach
you had to write a letter.
Right.
So who knows who's going to get that
right.
letter.
So I really started to feel the effects of it, because you have to keep in mind that my so-called life has never been unavailable since it was canceled, which is crazy for a show that only lasted a year.
Well, everyone thinks it went out for so many
because
more
it was
seasons.
On a loop on MTV for so many years. So about 4 years after, once I started going out to the clubs in West Hollywood and in New York, that's when people would start coming up to me, and I would hear the stories of, you know, you changed my life, or that character helped me see myself, or, you know, I didn't kill myself because I didn't feel alone. I spoke to my parents about who I was. I came out to a teacher. I mean, there isn't a day, and this is not an exaggeration, in 25 years, where somebody has not shared how important Ricky Vasquez was to them. And that's really moving. It still brings, you know, it still moves me. It's still really moving to me to hear that, because some people wait a whole lifetime to have an impact with their work. And I started my career that way. So the rest of the career was, you know, a little pressure to keep up with that, you know?
Was there, you know, listen, when you were out, I mean, this is, you know, people weren't out then.
No.
You know?
If anything, people were going back into the closet because of the yeah.
Was there a time where, like, you said, oh, what have I done? I really just messed up my career, or how am I going to get those roles that maybe roles that you didn't even want, but just, you know, who had your team said, ooh.
Well, I mean, early on, people on my team were not thrilled.
Right.
But let's be realistic. I am who I am. It's not like I'm walking around, you know, butch.
But,
you know,
but let's remember that there are people who thought Liberace was a straight,
totally,
you know, heartthrob.
Yes. So, you know, I think in every career, right? Mm-hmm. You talk to any actor who starts out young, there's always a lull of some sort where you're like, ugh, you know, my time is over. And I went through a period of that in the early 2000s where I was doing, you know, guest spot after guest spot and just trying to stay alive, right? Just trying to keep my head above water. And, you know, there were times during that period when I thought, oh, you know, maybe I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. But then I would think, who would I be? Who would I try to be? You know, I can only be this person, this authentic person. And I also believed that because I was being authentic in my life, that I could use all of that in my work. I couldn't do a double acting role, right? I'm not that talented. I couldn't act like a straight person and then, you know, take on another role at the same time. One role at a time, as far as I'm concerned. So, but I also think that it made me a better actor. Mm-hmm. I think being honest with yourself is part of the job, and living as authentically as you can is part of the job, because it informs everything. So I have no regrets. I went through a period where I wondered, mm-hmm. you know, what would have been different, but I have no regrets.
What's your advice for a young LGBTQ actor right now?
I mean, my advice to an actor right now, LGBTQ or not, is study, right? Like, I think so many people decide, oh, I'm going to be an actor, and don't really put the work in to actually figure out how to do this.
Mm-hmm. But what about the, you know, the LGBTQ kid actor, you know, who says, should I hide who I am or not?
Oh, I hope that we've made it a little safer, mm-hmm. A lot safer for someone to not even have that question, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes, I think at this point. You know, I think less and less people who are starting their careers are worried about the effects of being out on that career. You know, now people come out like on an Instagram post or, you know, like a Twitter post. It's that flippant of a coming out, right. Whereas before, you know, you'd have to call up the Advocate, and there'd be a cover, and, you know, People magazine, and all this stuff, or Variety. But I think people feel more capable and willing to do that, and I hope that continues.
And I would think, because you were out from the start, it protected you in circumstances, you know, talking about Me Too, where these. We know the stories of gay actors who are taken advantage of with the threat of,
yeah.
You tell anyone, I'm going to out you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, nobody was messing with
protecting you from that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there were people who are no longer with us, mm-hmm. who, you know, offered their help if I were to be willing to help them in some way,
right?
Physically. And I was really capable of removing myself from those scenarios. Mm-hmm.
Which I think comes from, I would say in part, from being out. You had that.
I didn't have
you, to. You can't mess with me. I've been through that.
Right. Yeah. I had the power in that situation. Right. I held on to my own power in that way. Yes, for sure. But I was also really good at being charming and get myself out of, oh, look at you, oh, stop, I'm gonna go. You know, I would just, and I'd roll my eyes, but yeah. That, a lot of people weren't as lucky as I am in that regard.
Okay, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, Cruz recalls getting cast in Star Trek. Plus, he remembers his early auditions and what it took to finally land his first job. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's more of Wilson Cruz.
And let's talk about the AIDS epidemic. Because, yeah. I mean, listen, you have Peter Stalley on the, and he is...
an icon.
What I found fascinating, you know, Peter Stalley is one of the earliest AIDS activists, founder of ACT UP. What I found amazing is when he's talking about how they use television. Mm-hmm. I guess I never really knew that they were really, because there was a lot of media people who were involved with, you know, AIDS activism, and they knew mm-hmm. how to use the medium of television.
Not only they used television, but they knew that they needed to be on 60 Minutes, because they knew that America, there are very few appointment TV opportunities that have lasted as long as 60 Minutes. Right. Like every, you know, so many people watch 60 Minutes, and this was at the height. I think we still only had three networks at that point.
Right.
So they knew, ACT UP knew that if they could get a 60-minute story, and they fought for it because they knew once they were on 60 Minutes that people would pay attention. And within 3 years of that 60-minute story airing, they tripled the budget at the NIH in terms of AIDS research. So they were strategic. Mm.
I knew they were strategic, and they knew they had to get attention.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. People, ACT UP had been around, and they were being depicted as the angry gays.
Right.
But nobody talked about why they were angry. Right? They knew that it had something to do with AIDS. But I think they literally put a human face on it. And Peter was that face.
Yeah.
He was everybody's son.
Yeah.
And I think they saw their own children in him. Mm. And he was literally fighting for his life. And in that story, he's asked, do you think you'll be around to see a cure? And he says, no, I think, you know, he thought and thinks in that moment that, you know, he was fighting for the lives of people who came after him. And he still does that. Yeah. He still feels that way. I was just with him last week, and they're still fighting the fight. So it was important to have Peter as a part of this. Because he literally did save our lives, all of us.
So you're starting off in acting, you're going to your auditions, you're doing your thing.
Yeah.
One day I'm going to be on Star Trek. One day I'm going to be an openly gay couple on Star Trek.
Yeah.
Is that anything that could have entered your mind?
I mean, I used to watch Next Gen growing up. I was a teenager. That was my Star Trek. And I thought, oh my God, it'd be so freaking cool to be on Star Trek. And I really, all I wanted to do was like be on Broadway and be in Star Trek. But I never thought either one, you know, like I never thought that was going to be real. You know, it was just like, it was a goal that you said, and it was a dream, really.
Right.
So no, I never thought it would actually happen. Especially since there hadn't been an openly gay character on Star Trek at all. So, you know, Anthony and I talk about it all the time, that we find ourselves lucky and also feel responsible in some way to make sure that we get it right. And what I love about the show is that our sexuality is hardly a talking point. You know, it's really about love. These two people love each other, and they also happen to be geniuses who live on board of a starship and save the world with their friends.
Did you have to do a chemistry read?
No, I mean, we've known each other for 20 years, so I think the network and the studio were like, well, they obviously know each other.
Because they're two gay guys.
Right, well, they knew we had done Rent together.
Right.
So, but, you know, TV's fast, as you know, and so there's not a whole lot of rehearsal time, and I think the reason why we work is because we use our actual friendship and love for each other as a foundation for creating this relationship. And it feels familiar, and it feels, I hope anyway, I think for me anyway, it feels like these people have been together for a long time. And so I think that's because we really honestly like each other.
So who found out, who got cast first?
Oh, he did. He got cast
first. So he gets cast first.
Yeah.
Then.
So he gets cast first. I find out about it because I had reached out to Brian Fuller because I had let him know that when he was creating this that I would have loved to have been a part of it. Then he hands it over to Aaron and Gretchen, and I reach out to them because I had done the finale of Pushing Daisies, the series finale, and they were like, you know, they reached down, they were like, we would love that. And they reached down, they're like, by the way, we're casting Anthony Rapp. And I was like, I love him. I love Anthony Rapp. You're going to love working with, they didn't know him. And I sent him a note. And then like 2 weeks later, I get the call that they want to offer me the part of his partner, which was just recurring at the time. But I was like, yes, absolutely. And
Did you even know this part existed? Or is it?
I mean, no, because I thought once they cast Anthony that was it. That was my chance. Yeah, there was the one gay character who knew that they were going to have two. But they did. And it was pretty seamless. I mean, once they offered it to me, I had to put myself on tape with Aaron and Gretchen for the studio just because they were more worried about if I looked old enough to be the doctor on Star Trek. So I guess I just let myself look haggard that day.
Drawing wrinkles on your face?
Right, didn't shave, I don't know. But it's such a great gig, I have to be. And like, we just finished season 3, and you know, I actually get to do a lot more doctoring this season, and they've given me this really epic storyline. You know, this is a man who falls in love and is in a great relationship, and then is killed and comes back to life, and
So TV.
Is a better doctor now because of it. It's a great part. It's maybe the best part I've had.
Tell me the moment where you and Anthony are on set and you just look at each other going, holy shit.
Well, I'll tell you. The moment was when we had our first kiss. It was mm-hmm. the first gay kiss on Star Trek.
Right.
And well, actually, you know, even before that, when we did a scene where our characters are revealed to be a couple, and we're brushing our teeth just like a normal couple would at the end of the night. And before we shot that scene, we just kind of turned to each other and looked at each other like, this is really happening. Like, we get to do this. This is a big deal. But we have that moment all the time. I mean, I think when you're walking around the set, I mean, if you ever visit the set, you'll see it's very immersive. You feel like you're on a starship. It's crazy because it's huge. It's a huge set. But we have that moment all the time where we look at each other and just say, we're on Star Trek. This is weird.
Good, I love that. I love that.
We do. We're very aware.
Two fun questions and then I'll let you go. Your first audition ever, whether you got the role or not.
Oh, you know, it was probably a commercial, mm-hmm. which I was really bad at. And I only had a commercial agent for like 5 years. And it was, you know, it was like a Spanish, because at the time it was like 1991, 92. And I only had a commercial agent. So I went on all these really terrible, like McDonald's Spanish commercials, you know, where they didn't even have copy. They would give you like an English version and then ask you to translate it. It was very
what? Bizarre.
Yeah, I didn't get any of those. I begged to be let in for my first audition for a television show that I was wrong for because they wanted three white boys to play choir boys on this series that Tobey Maguire was starring in. It was called Great Scott on Fox, and they wouldn't see me because I wasn't white. And so I kind of stormed Sally Steiner's office mm-hmm. and kind of begged her to see me, and she did, because I wouldn't relent. And she got me that part. She was like, you're a freaking fighter, so wow. Come on. And so that I got my SAG card, and because I got my SAG card from that show, I was able to audition for My So-Called Life the following season.
Wow. And what's the one?
So go and do your own things, kids.
Storm the casting agents.
Yes. Don't tell him I told you, though.
And what's the one TV show you could watch over and over again, and it just never gets boring?
Oh, there's so many. Honestly, I'm going to say this because I just recently did this. 6 Feet Under.
Yeah, why?
I just think the acting on there is brilliant, and it was always unexpected. You never knew where it was going, and I just loved that family. And the series finale of 6 Feet Under is my favorite hour of television ever. I think it's just impeccably written. It's the best series finale I've ever seen. And it's really moving. And that Sia song, well, every time I hear it, Breathe, I'm undone by it just because I remember that episode.
Wilson Chris, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
That was Wilson Cruz. Visible Out on Television is available now on Apple TV Plus. Coming up after the break, Olivia Munn. We talk weddings, Tiger King, and Harvey Weinstein. I'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's Olivia Munn.
So how are you surviving in coronavirus world?
I'm surviving and very grateful.
Yeah.
You hear how many people are struggling and how many people are not surviving. And it's definitely surreal. You know, yeah. I had two friends die unexpectedly, actually within a week and a half of each other. And that was such a crazy, very surreal experience. They're both young. One was actually a very new mother. She had her baby one day and then passed away unexpectedly the next. Another friend of mine, my best friend from high school, and she was diagnosed with colon cancer just a couple weeks before and then died. And we thought that she had more months of fighting and all that. And so it's a very surreal feeling to go through a loss like that, because it feels like it didn't really happen, you know? So much a part of grief is the grieving of it and the community of it, and grieving together with people and being able to hug my friends' moms or husbands and say goodbye. And so it's a very strange, dreamlike state to not be able to say goodbye to people. And that when you get on the other side of this, it's like, oh, and they're not there. And because right now, no one, you know, we're all, you know, sheltering down. So there is this feeling of, you know, being on an island, right? We're all on our own little individual islands. And you think, okay, but on the other side, you know, we'll all reunite again. And I think that that's probably been the most heartbreaking thing for me during this, you know, is not being, you know, not being able to grieve and say goodbye properly.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Were you working on anything? Were you in production on anything when all of this went down, or?
I was in pre-production on stuff. I sold a show to Amazon that we've been working on and writing and doing that. So that was pre-production on that. Some other scripts I was writing that we were on, you know, final stages of. So I'm lucky to say that it was just all pre-production stuff that,
right.
It was all stuff that we'd be doing, you know, from home and office anyways.
Right.
And I did have I had a movie I was really proud of that Justine Bateman wrote and directed. Right. And that got into South by Southwest into the competition.
I saw. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was really happy for Justine to have that experience, and was really proud of her. You know, it's her first time directing a full-length feature film, and I was just really excited for her. And there's a lot of conversation leading up to, like, is South by Southwest going to get canceled? We don't know. It was just, and it was really difficult because to make that decision, because I didn't know, like, really what to do. You know, I'm like, I was looking at, like, all these big corporations were canceling, and I called Justine and I was like, you know, I mean, if you go, I'll go, you know, I'll be there to support you. But you're kind of waiting for, like, it's almost like you're waiting for the parents to say, no, we're not going to go. And if nobody says that, then, you know, you go, because I think if you're built like a lot of us here in America, which is, you know, we want to be team players. We all want to, you know, show up for each other.
And as a person of Asian descent, what's your reaction when you see the racism that just sprout, you know, just automatically, it just, this world just, everyone's looking for scapegoats.
Yeah, it's, I think, you know, it's really disappointing to hear that. It's very scary, and it makes me, you know, scared for myself, my family members, friends, other people, you know, within the Asian community. You know, it's, you know, at the end of the day, like you just said, it boils down to people wanting someone to blame, or they need a target to take out their frustrations and anger, you know? So, you know, it's, that seems such like an archaic response that it didn't seem real at first. I thought that's great. I mean, that seems crazy. And then you hear the president saying it like that, and you just think, I mean, it's just, like when there is violence amongst, you know, party lines, when there are, you know, Trump supporters who are, you know, fighting, you know, or beating down somebody or attacking somebody else, we don't call it, like, you know, the Trump violence. Right. He wouldn't like that. So, you know, it's, to me, it's just a scary time. And I'm really grateful for the people, you know, and the media that have, like, you know, put out those stories so that people can, so that there's a lot more support. You know, that's the thing, is that when people get shamed by the community, when the whole world, you know, and media and people are looking at blogs and social media and saying, like, this is happening, that's crazy. That's right. Like, it's obscene. So that you end up getting a lot more support, I think. And so hopefully like that's waning. But it's a hard thing to, what do you think about it?
It's just not something that I thought of until we started seeing the reports of it. Like, how do you even go there?
I know.
Like, I didn't think it was a group of people who are to blame for it. But then, you know, you talk to gay men of a certain age and they're like, yep, this is what AIDS was. You know, it was gay men were being attacked. They were being blamed for it. And I'm like, yep, that's sort of the same thing. And I think it's just people look for scapegoats. I don't know if it gives them a sense of control or a sense of explaining it, because there's no way of explaining this. That you find something that you latch onto. And, you know, the fact is we have a lot of racist people in this country. So let's talk about escapism from this crazy upside down world, which you're providing some of that. Love, wedding, repeat.
Yes. Yeah.
My husband and I were laughing.
Oh, yay. Have you watched it then?
Yes, of course. Oh, yeah.
Exciting.
It's really sweet. It's just a nice break. Didn't have to think about coronavirus. And got to see a fun, silly rom-com.
Well, that's exactly what we actually wanted it to be, received like by people. We wanted it to be this really light, fun, romantic comedy. We have this great ensemble cast, you know, all these amazing British actors and comedians, and an Irish comedian actually with Ashlyn B. They were just the most fun people to work with. And that's what I really loved about the script, was that it was this really fun romantic comedy with an ensemble cast, which is, you know, I think for me, like a dream come true.
So how did you get involved?
So this movie actually came to me, say like a year and a half or so before I actually, we filmed. But it was with a different director. Mm. And then the director, his TV show ended up getting picked up on, I think, the BBC. And so he couldn't direct it. But then the writer of the film, Dean Craig, sat down with me and asked if I would be okay if he directed it. And so I said, yeah, of course. You know, I love Dean, thought he was such a great guy. So then once that happened, I think they were trying to figure out the dates with the other director for a while. That's why it took so long. Then once once Dean was on, and then we locked in Sam Claflin after that, and then all the other pieces fell in place.
So give us a little log line. Give us a brief summary of what happens in this crazy little rom-com.
Well, this movie is, like I said, it's a lighthearted romantic comedy about the choices you make and how those can change the course of your destiny. It's really interesting. It's like this, you know, fantasy about how things can go right, even if they go wrong at first. Mm-hmm. It was based off this French film called Plan de Table, I think is how you pronounce it. I don't speak French, so I'm
probably butchering
that. But it looks like Plan de Table, which I understand to be like the table placements and settings. And so the movie is like, it's like if everybody sat at a table and, you know, you have your place settings, and what if things were just changed slightly and now everybody was sitting in a different seat? So how could everything change from that one moment? And just those small choices that really just completely change your life. So in this movie, Sam Claflin, plays Jack, and he is at his sister's wedding, and Jack has a history of bad luck. He just kind of always, right about to have really good luck, and it just kind of all just disintegrates for him for some reason. So he and my character, Dina, had met, a year or so before, and we had a spark. There was a moment, but of course, with his bad luck, it didn't come to fruition. And at this wedding, he finds out that I'm there, and my character and his character, they think they've always been kind of wondering like, what if? And so during the film, we see, you know, if their seats were next to each other, what would be like? And then if they were separated, what life would be like. And in the midst of all of that, we've got a lot of different dynamics where, you know, Sam's character's, ex-girlfriend is at the table with her new fiance, who's really pissed about, you know, Sam being there. And you've got, you know, amazing character actors like Joel Fry and Tim Key, Jack Farthing, like Ashlyn B, who's so funny. I think during this filming, I want to do every, almost every project if I can with Ashlyn and Tim Key. They make me laugh so hard. They're just the funniest people. And I just was just, I mean, enamored with them.
So where did you shoot?
We shot in this 17th century Villa Parisi in Frascati, which is like 13 miles outside of central Rome. Wow. And it was beautiful. It's like what you think about with Rome. It's these amazing castles and like all this, like, you know, vineyards and greenery. And it was just beautiful. Yeah. So I got to spend like a little over a month in Rome working.
That's not bad.
No, it was amazing. we had you know, an Italian crew. And so, you know, we'd be, you know, learning, you know, Italian. I was there. Can't remember any of the Italian. but we love being able to work with this Italian crew and with everybody. You know, it was an ensemble, so we're all getting to hang out together all the time and laugh. You know, this is like what you dream of, you know, just to go to work and laugh every day.
So do you like weddings?
You know, what's funny is I've only gone to, I'm going to say 4 weddings in my life.
Really?
Maybe 5 total. Definitely no more than like one hand. Yeah. I don't go to a lot of weddings, but the weddings I have gone to, I do find boring. Like, I feel like, also, I always think this is interesting at weddings. I feel like the wedding part is really for whoever's marrying them, because you only see the backs of your friends' heads.
Right. And then I never understood that.
I'm like, why am I just sitting here, like, looking at the back of your head? And it's a big performance for whoever you've just booked. Like, this is amazing. We get to watch them do this whole thing. And then after that, you know, we've got, like, you know, the dinners, the party, you know, it just feels like every time I've been to them, it's been like, there's just, it can be quite boring.
I've been to some that are boring. Mm-hmm. I've been to some that are fun. It depends on my mood. My husband and I, we just got married at the Beverly Hills Courthouse for an afternoon, went to lunch afterwards with a bunch of friends. And that was it.
That's very Carrie Bradshaw of you.
Very Carrie.
That's literally what she did. She got at the courthouse and they went to have lunch at like a diner.
It was beautiful. It was wonderful. Do you have a dream? Do you have a dream wedding for yourself or?
No, I've never been that girl. And I'll hear about friends going, and I've just never been the person that's like, oh, I can't wait to get married. I can't, this is what it's going to be like. What my ring would be. I don't really have any of those. The idea of getting married has always kind of made me a little it gives me like I'm like, it's hot in here, right? It's like, where it's like, really, do we? I just didn't it just felt like to pick one person forever. And also like the dynamic of like, how can you have a friendship like that goes on for all, you know, like all of my friendships I love, but the dynamic in a romantic relationship, you know, the idea of like, I'm like, maybe I just haven't found like the one that I'm like, oh yeah, I can see this way, you know, like.
For me, when my husband and I got together, I told him, I said, we're not getting married, by the way. Like, mm-hmm. That's not a thing. That's nothing I dreamt about. It's not happening. And he always dreamed about it. He always had like, I want to get married. I want the guy on one knee, the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
And then it was during when we were already living together, but it was during the Supreme Court, and then gay marriage became legal. And I got very emotional about it. And I was very obviously vocal about it. And he's like, I don't understand. You're so emotional about it, but why don't you want to get married? I'm like, this is not something I thought about. And then one night, out of nowhere, didn't plan it, I just said to him, I said, you want to do it? And he's like, do what? And I said, get married. He's like, you're kidding. I'm like, I would not kid about that. He's like, fine, you have to get down on one knee.
I know, I'm about to ask you. I was like, he just told you, he wanted you.
Well, the best was our first Christmas together. I bought him a signet ring, you know, like from Tiffany's. And as we're only together at that point, like 6 months. And he's opening the box and it hit me.
And you're like.
And I screamed, it's not an engagement ring.
It's not that ring. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I ended up finding the guy and it's the best thing I've ever done. I advise everyone to do it.
That's great.
We're going to take another quick break, but when we return, Mun, a longtime animal rights activist, sounds off on Tiger King. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's Olivia Mun.
One thing you've been doing during all of this crazy pandemic is you've been promoting fostering dogs. Tell me about that.
Well, that's just been really such an important cause right now because of, you know, like right now, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic has really created this unprecedented animal sheltering crisis in the U.S. And you know, there's all these homeless pets with nowhere to go and they're at risk of being euthanized right now.
Right.
And of course, like right now people don't always know this, but like right now it's like puppy and kitten season. Mm-hmm. So there's already this increase in animals going into shelters and, without the walking traffic of people going in to the shelters, the animals aren't finding homes right now. So, myself and WAG partnered with greatergood.org to promote this thing called Stay Home and Foster. And if you go to stayhomeandfoster.org, basically you can sign up and then it will connect you to a shelter near you. And then they will start to show you like animals that are in need of a home that you could foster and or adopt if you wanted that in your life. I mean, having an animal or a pet in your life, you know, it's so great for, you know, the animal, of course, but also for people in this situation right now too, during isolation, it's really great for depression and anxiety and just having something else to care for is a really great thing to have in times like this.
And obviously you're a big animal rights activist, advocate.
Yeah.
So have you watched Tiger King?
Yes. And I'm also from Oklahoma.
Oh my God. Okay. So go tell me what you think.
Well, it was just a hot mess of a world. And, you know, animals like this should really be free to, you know, big cats, really, you know, so many animals that like deserve to live their life out outside of captivity. It's so important. And, it was just very sad. It was very sad. I mean, it was, you know, there's a lot of entertaining elements to it, but to me, it just came off as just really sad when you see what these animals are going through and how people just treating them like currency and there's no emotion or connection to it at all. And, you know, and there's such a, I think a lack of empathy, not just for the people who are profiting off of this, but the people who pay to have these experiences with these animals. You know, when you go to resorts around the world and they say you can go swim with the dolphins, those dolphins are in captivity and it's horrific. Dolphins are like incredibly intelligent mammals. And yet they are forced to live in, basically if somebody put us into our swimming pool and said, stay there for the rest of your life. And it's basically, if we were in isolation right now, you know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, Joe Exotic talks about being in prison and how, you know, he feels so horrible because he, you know, imprisoned his animals for so long. But what really is an important thing for people to understand is not just the people like Joe Exotic or even the Carol Baskin who has tigers in, you know, in her sanctuary there, that, you know, if she really does care about animals, then she should go find other sanctuaries that have so much more property for these animals to roam freely and to be able to live their best life in that situation, because they're not in the cages at her place either. But What's really important, I think the most important takeaway from Tiger King is that the public, consumers, customers, that we are responsible for saving these animals as well. Because if we don't pay for those experiences, these people can't make money and profit off of that. So these animals will become invaluable, you know, or unvaluable to them.
Being from Oklahoma, did you know anything about this Joe Exotic or his zoo that he had?
No, I mean, I had no idea, but, you know, I don't think that's a reflection of Oklahoma. Either. I think that, you know, from everything I know about being raised in Oklahoma, you know, my family's in Oklahoma, like, you know, a lot of people who really love and care about animals and care about, you know, being humane and treating, you know, everything with kindness. So this is a very startling, very important, you know, although it's very entertaining for people, what the important thing is for people to realize that things like this go on, even if you don't know about it.
Right.
And it's really important for people to see that, like, all these people who want to, it's so cute to hold a baby tiger or a baby, you know, cheetah or a, you know, baby monkey, and everybody wants to do those things, but all you're doing is you're aiding in the abuse. And that if you pay for any of these experiences, even if it's something as small as, I just want a picture with a, you know, with me swimming with dolphins or holding a tiger, that you are complicit in the abuse and exploitation of these really special animals.
How many dogs do you have now?
I have my two, Frankie and Chance. They I rescued both of them. People could see them across the country right now, nationwide campaign with the Humane Society and the Shelter Pet Project to get people to want to rescue shelter pets. And so they're just so great and so sweet. I love them. They're like, it's like just the best. They're my older dog, Chance. He's being trained to be a service dog to go into nursing homes and children's hospitals. His favorite thing in life is to love and be loved. It's like he's just the most social dog. He just loves it. And so my brother and his girlfriend, whenever I have to go film, they'll take my dogs for me and watch them for me. And so in Virginia, where they are, they, you know, he's been going through the school. And so that way, when I'm on set and I'm traveling, this is what he can be doing, is going into nursing homes and hospitals. I know. It's like, if you ever get a chance to be around him, you'll see, like, his favorite thing in the world is just saying hi to people. He loves it so much. It's just, I feel like it's my duty as, you know, his, you know, dog mother to fulfill this thing for him, because that's definitely his life's purpose, I think.
Now, I know you've tweeted about Harvey Weinstein and the verdict. What do you think is the next step? What's next?
Well, I think it's important that we keep holding people accountable for their actions. I think that it's important that we continue to support people who speak out. I think it's, you know, it's important to also call out the people who are complicit in keeping these people in positions of power, because it was beneficial for them as well. And, you know, I think it's always really important in throughout any of this is to, you know, people need to speak out, name names, and, you know, and we need to believe them. And there has to be, you know, but, you know, we need to also, you know, I said this before when it comes to a lot of this stuff, is that, you know, when you hear about something that's been written about in a newspaper or a publication like Variety, Hollywood, New York Times, LA Times, you know, any publication, for them to actually write the story, for the publication to write the story, there has to be a lot of evidence to support it, because the lawyers would never let the publication go forward with that story. So if you've read about it in a legitimate publication, know that there was enough evidence to support this person calling out you know, an abuser. And so it's important to believe them when you hear these stories that go out. You know, it's also important to, for people to come forward with evidence and, or witnesses and people they spoke to at the time, anything that helps to validate that, because it's really important that there are things that support people speaking out and calling out people, because that's the one thing that keeps it from becoming something where people can say that, oh, it's just everybody is just calling people out without any evidence or without saying, you know, that anybody is at risk for being called out.
Right.
It's just like kind of a cancel culture, which is not the case. You know, like I said, when in publications, you know, people are getting called out. And the truth is that if somebody gets called out and it's not true, then there would be a defamation case against them.
Right. Right.
And, you know, there hasn't been. So it's really important for us to believe people when they speak out, especially when you read it in legitimate publications. And it's also important for people who speak out to name names so that people can know who not to work with, and also to help save other people who may, you know, have been suffering from, you know, an abuse that they had to endure at the hands of this person. And so, you know, there is strength in numbers. It's also important for people to come forward with, you know, the right evidentiary support so that, you know, it can be easily believed. And that is important, because it's not enough just to say something. And that's the truth. People want to think that it is, but it's not. You need to be able to have some support to it. If it's, you know, if you have enough support that a publication will go out with it, then that's good.
Right.
You know, until then, you know, you have to be careful, because if you say something, you don't have the stuff to back it up. You could put you into a real legal situation that's going to be tough to get out of and very costly. So that's why I stress as well in this, is that, you know, we need to believe people, but the people who come, you know, who want to speak out, I just implore you to have the right evidentiary proof to support what you're saying so that you don't get into a very costly legal battle.
Do you hear from people still saying, I want to speak out, I have something that happened to me, but I'm too scared?
Yeah, I get connected with people a lot through different avenues and different people, and I get people talking to me a lot. And there are times when I've heard stories and I say, you know, look, I'm sorry that happened to you, but if this person wasn't in the public eye, you know, you wouldn't really be telling the story. And, and really that's a situation that, you know, you weren't, you know, it's one of those live and learns, you know, it wasn't, there's nothing the person did. They did something morally wrong, but not illegal. And I do suggest to people, you know, not to speak up. This, you know, that person doesn't sound like a great person, or that anybody I want one of my friends to date, it's not enough to take down their career and to put yourself into a very difficult, very costly legal situation. There are other times when I tell people 100% what happened to you was horrible, and it is, you know, from what my understanding is, it seems like there is, you know, whatever happened, if it is true, is enough to go forward and to let the world know about this. However, you don't have enough evidentiary proof. There isn't any friend that you told during that time. There isn't text messages that you shared with someone. You know, you don't have anybody that can support what you're saying. And I'm not saying that I don't believe, I'm just saying I don't want you to get into a situation where you could be sued for defamation. So although I hear what you're saying and it's horrible, you shouldn't go forward. And then there have been times where I have said to people, you need to go forward. You have everything. You will be protected. You will be protected by everything that happened around it, how many people you told, what other proof you have, what steps you took, whether you reported it to producers, whether you report it to a boss, whether you report it to, you know, you, if you've done, taken those steps, and I see all that, then I have encouraged people to go forward, and they have because of that. So yeah, I still, you know, I'm still in communication with people, and I try to give them the best advice that I think I can. And it's not always going to be, yes, go forward and do that. And it's not always going to be like, I don't think that you should, you know, it just depends on every situation.
That was Olivia Munn. Love, Wedding, Repeat is available on Netflix tomorrow, April 10th. Thanks for listening to The Big Ticket. Coming up next week, Sandra Oh talking about the new season of Killing Eve. Until then, make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. See you next time.